We just broke the all-time high, which was around 70, right? 65, 70. This administration, there is nothing that is more bullish from a political standpoint that has ever happened to Bitcoin and crypto. The U.S. government, with the largest economy and the wealthiest population, has taken on crypto on their platform.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. We just had a pivotal US election, and you can feel the momentum in the market shifting. In the 9 days since Trump's victory was announced, Bitcoin has moved higher by 30% and the S&P has reached a new all-time high. This new market environment is creating a world of opportunity for investors. Few people understand markets better than veteran macro investor Dan Tapiro. I reached out to Dan after the election and we recorded a very insightful conversation about what's ahead for Bitcoin and crypto markets. We discussed insights from Dan's career and how those have influenced his views, his investment principles and targets, what he expects to see for Bitcoin, regulations, crypto-related IPOs, and much, much more. If you're an investor or builder in the space, you won't want to miss this. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Dan Tapiro. Dan, welcome to the show. Thank you for making time of your very busy schedule to come on today.
It's how long has it been? 6 months since I last saw you? We did this?
Well, we did one.
Was it a year ago?
A year ago, yeah, just over a year ago.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's crazy how time flies.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a changed circumstance now, right?
Just slightly.
Just slightly, yes.
We're going to get into that. The way I typically like to start the show is to start to paint a picture of the person or the human behind the professional. And the question I'd like to start with you is, you grew up in New York, you went to Lawrenceville School, which is one of the oldest schools in the US. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in the Tapiro household? And was finance or money a big thing in your family?
Oh, that's a surprise question. I don't usually get into the personal stuff publicly. Finance, I don't know that it was discussed a lot, but my grandfather had been a merchant banker and had his own bank in London in the 1940s and 50s. So I was aware of that aspect. And on my father's side, he wasn't in business, but the family in the previous generations had been. And so I was aware of commerce and activity, and I traveled a lot as a child. My whole father's family is in France and in Paris, and I used to go quite a lot as a child. And I remember doing lots of different currency conversions in my head at like age 8, 9, 10, 11, you know, going from dollars to French francs and then, you know, traveling in Europe as well. They all had all these different currencies. And then I would come back after the summer and I would just be in a dollar world. So I was very aware of currency. And my grandmother, of course, also, I remember her sitting with me very often, looking at the newspaper, checking the quotes on the stocks that she held. You know, this was after my grandfather died, and she had pretty significant stakes. And, you know, at the time, the big names, IBM, Texaco, you know, so I was aware of financial things. I was aware of currency. I don't know that there were sort of discussions about markets or things like that. And also, my grandfather and his father, too, had also, strangely enough, been involved in the gold business a little bit, just a little bit, which it's odd. I don't know that sparked an interest in gold, but maybe subconsciously, you know, when you hear about these things as a little child, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, it just sort of sticks with you.
It's fascinating to hear you say that, because this is exactly why I like asking this question, because I come to learn so much about what people ended up becoming later in life by a few key things that happened during their childhood.
But hold on a second. Okay. But I didn't study any of that in college.
That was my next question. You're jumping ahead to my next question, which is you went
born
to study
in Lawrenceville. I mean, there was no money, no economics, no finance, nothing.
But so that's my next question. So after that, you went to Brown and you did your undergrad and your master's in history.
Correct.
So what was it that inspired you to study history?
Well, so, you know, I remember growing up, of course, JFK had been a history major at Harvard. And it was, you know, in the early 80s, 70s, I guess, 80s, you know, studying liberal arts, many people in business and many certainly people in leadership positions had, you know, had studied history, majored in history. And look, I was fascinated and interested in it. My uncle was a very well-known historian at Princeton, a Renaissance historian. So growing up, I was always aware of that. And he actually, I can remember as a child, he hosted a whole series on PBS about the Renaissance. It was like a 10 or 12 part series. And it was his book that was the main book that you read in college at the time, called The Struggle for Stability in Early Modern Europe. So my uncle wrote that. And, you know, so you have a little bit of a connection. And I took to it. I loved reading. I loved thesis building. I was very into also expressing and articulating ideas in writing. I was the sports editor at Lawrenceville, the newspaper, and then I became the managing editor of the Brown Daily Herald for a time. So I continued that and writing hundreds of articles about sometimes really mundane matters, sometimes, you know, interesting things, but being able to synthesize a thought quickly, write it down quickly. I mean, I had, you know, lots of articles that I wrote in literally 15 minutes. And I had a brilliant editor there who sort of was my mentor, who actually, you know, really helped me learn how to write these terse sentences. One of the reasons that I like doing Twitter, you know, people always say to me, oh, it must take you so such a long, I mean, sometimes I just post a chart, it takes 30 seconds. But honestly, the skill of being able to write a clear thought quickly and leave you with an impression, that comes from years and years ago of having been sort of an amateur editor. But history and the history of ideas and philosophy was what I was really interested in. So, you know, it's the same process as investment. I mean, I know it's weird for people to hear this, but, you know, I would read 20 books on a topic and then I would come up with my own thesis. And, you know, that is sort of the same thing that I've been doing my whole life, is reading widely, digesting different opinions, and coming up with a view about the future. And so the thing I liked about investing, and again, it was sort of in the background always, but, you know, my family always encouraged me to also study non-business things. I mean, it was very important to be properly read and, you know, steeped in, I think, the great works of the Western tradition. And that's what I was. I mean, at Brown, one of the reasons I went there, aside from just because I wanted to play water polo there, which was sort of the main reason, but was that you didn't have to do requirements. And so at Lawrenceville, I had a very rigorous high school education. I mean, I really did not. That was a very difficult place academically. I think it's a little less that way. I mean, I've been on the board there now for 16 years. So it's a little less, I think, less harsh. And at the time, it was not co-ed either. So you can imagine, you know, a bunch of boys in the freezing winter, day in, day out, with these old masters who'd lived through the World War II and Korea. And it was a tougher, and academically it was really tough. But, you know, so after Lawrenceville, I wanted to go somewhere where I didn't have to take math and science, things that I didn't really have a natural affinity for at Brown. I mean, I took whole semesters on, you know, Chaucer and Nietzsche. I mean, art history. I did mostly philosophy, history, and literature exclusively. And then I decided to stay an extra year and do a master's in history because I'd already taken many of the requirements for a master's as an undergraduate. And usually a master's is 2 years, but I could do a combined BA, MA program in 5 years. So, of course, I thought, well, this is great. My family was very encouraging as well. So I continued on for another year. But I'm telling you, it's the same. The process of thinking about history is the same process that you go through in thinking about the future. So there's a long-winded answer. People are probably like, damage, enough of this stuff, right? Maurizio, you didn't know what you got into with that question.
No, I find this fascinating because I try to think of, my dad has this saying that, you know, my dad says Venezuelans come from the future. And what I like about that is like history rhymes, right? Like he says that in the context of we've seen a currency get debased to basically death. And basically, when you look at what's happening in countries that are going through the same, you see a lot of similarities. And as an investor, you can basically start anticipating what had happened before to reoccur again, because a lot of the times it's the same incentives, it's the same setups, it's very similar dynamics.
And well, it's the exact same thing. And I ended up doing that for 25 to 30 years in the hedge fund business. You know, I was generally focused on currencies, but commodities, interest rates, stocks as well. But, you know, my first entry into the business, really my first big, I would say, investment that I ever did really was during the ERM crisis when I was working at Tiger in 1992 and 93. And without getting into all that again, because I've talked about that publicly, very fortunate to be put in the hot seat at what at the time was one of the three sort of largest hedge funds in the world. But, you know, we were breaking these currency pegs because the fundamentals didn't warrant the valuations at which they were pegged. And the funny part is that the analytical process that was used to get to the conclusion that those certain currencies should go down in value was the exact same analysis used by me and others 5 years later to predict the Asian currency crisis and for us to make assessments about the value of those Asian currencies being pegged to the dollar at the wrong valuations given the fundamentals. And so, you know, you're right, the process about determining value of a currency is not something that many people, you know how to do or have a lot of experience with. And of course, gold is a currency. So that was a natural shift for me as well. Later on, when I ended up starting my physical gold sales and storage business, Gold Bullion International, GBI, which now is still thriving. And then of course, it was just a small leap to Bitcoin, which of course is a currency. And then Ethereum, and then all the other cryptocurrencies, you know, probably Solana. I think that these are all, you know, Bitcoin, ETH, and Solana now, I think, probably have achieved network effect. Bitcoin, of course. Everything else is a little more venture capital-like, I think. But Bitcoin, ETH are sort of separate. Anyway, so people say, well, how do you own that? Well, I've always come up with interesting ways to value new assets. I did this when I was working for Druckenmiller. He and I launched an agricultural farmland REIT together with Goldman helping us. And, you know, I came up with a new way, I think at the time, to value farmland. And we built that into a farmland REIT that ended up becoming one of the largest private farmland holdings in the United States. And we ended up selling that, funnily enough, Mauricio, to the CPP, the Canadian Pension Fund System, for $450 million. That was in 2013. They then turned around like 3 years ago and sold it to Bill Gates. So Bill Gates now owns all of our original farms. But the point is that the process of looking at a new asset and coming up with a way to value it is what I've done my whole life and comes from the, you know, the same analytical process that I learned, you know, really in high school, in writing theses, and then in college. So there's been a very sort of clear, you know, path. And I've jumped around to different assets as they've, you know, developed and, you know, as they've come into being. Right. So I think that's, people say, like, well, how do you have any comfort? Like, no one's ever valued Bitcoin. How do you say when it's good, when you think it, 2019, I said, I think it can go up to 300, 350,000. Like, where do you get that number from? So, you know, I probably have six or seven different ways that I got there. Right. So that's, you know, that process is the same. And I think I'm just confirming what you said.
No, absolutely. And I want to ask you a little bit about your view on the Bitcoin breakout and where do you think we can go? But I wanted to go back to your interest in gold. You know, when I asked ChatGPT about Dan Tapiero, and as I was getting prepared for this, you keep coming up as a person that became a big advocate for gold even before it was cool, even before it was mainstream, even before it was considered like a staple portfolio asset. And you, I think of the gold investors as the OG Bitcoiners. How did gold tick for you? What was it about gold that ticked for you?
Well, there are different phases of it. I mean, gold, I started trading gold in the mid-90s. It bottomed out in the early 2000s. The first, like, it's had different bull phases. The first phase sort of into 07, 08, before the 08 crisis, was really about China's growth. I mean, people don't understand that, like, in the 90s, the Chinese economy in GDP terms was smaller than Canada's in the 90s, smaller than Canada. Yeah, go back and look at Chinese GDP circa 1995 or 97. It's smaller than Canada. Anyway, in the early 2000s, China just started to explode. And there was an idea that as the Chinese and Indians became wealthy and that they would buy more gold. And in fact, I think today, you know, 75% of consumption is from China, India, and the emerging world. So there was an idea in the early 2000s. I don't know if you remember, Jim O'Neill from Goldman Sachs came out and talked about BRICS, you know, that new Brazil, Russia, India, China. What was the last one?
South Africa, I think.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the emerging market thesis really took off. And they all still believed in gold as a store of value. And so, especially the Indians with jewelry, et cetera. And so that was sort of my first interest as like a big macro shift. And then after 08, it was sort of clear to me, 08 was a wonderful year for me. 07 was too, in terms of my business and trading. And it was clear after 08 that we were going to have to, you know, keep interest, negative real interest rates for many years. The system had been essentially almost broken. They saved Goldman and Morgan Stanley by turning them into banks. You know, we had that Reinhardt Rogoff thesis, which you can read now, which is about how negative real interest rates were going to be with us for quite a long time. And I thought, well, if I'm going to lose 3% a year in real terms in the bank over 10 years, I could lose almost, you know, 40, 50% of my savings over 10 years. I'm like, that's not going to work. And what's going to happen if they're debasing my savings to that degree? I'm going to own gold. So 08, with my partner, I launched a physical gold sales and storage business. And it was in the same time that Satoshi came out and wrote the white paper, the end of 08 into March 09. That's when I launched. Now, I didn't understand Bitcoin. I'm not a tech guy. I was never in the, you know, VC or tech back in 08, 09. But the fundamental backdrop of what had happened in the 08 crisis led me to invest in gold in the same way that it led Satoshi to invent Bitcoin. I'm not saying I'm on that par or anything like that. I'm just saying that at that time, many people understood that there was going to be massive debasement of people's savings to offset, you know, the debacle of 08. And rates were going to be held negative, real rates, for a long time. So, you know, it was not an obvious light bulb moment. But as a macro guy, you'd been, you know, waiting in a way for rates to continue to drop, right? They peaked in 82. And then, you know, they had a massive bull market in the 90s. Most of the big macro guys, you know, Soros and Druck and Julian and Lewis, they all made huge chunks of their money just being long bonds leveraged, because you can be long bonds in a very leveraged way. You know, you put down some fraction of 1% and you can control a huge amount of fixed income. You know, when you have interest rates going from 10% to 5 to 3 to 2, these are very big, you know, very big gains. And given the deficit spending, also, there was an idea that, you know, the federal government would have to keep rates at zero, just like Japan had, right? Japan had been the leader in this. The bubble popped in, you know, 89 or 90, whatever. And then interest rates, in the early 90s were 8% in Japan. And they went from 8 to 3. And then they were zero for many, many, many years. And they're basically kind of still zero. So Japan was thought by macro guys to be the leader because, you know, the leader country, because they had that excessive bubble, you know, much worse demographics and everything else. But so 08 was the culmination of a lot of different macro trends that had been ongoing for many, many years, and finally just burst in one go. You know, the economies would have, if the Fed hadn't come in and done TARP and TALF and all those other things, we would have had some sort of depression. And so they took the alternative route, which I'm glad and everyone is glad they did. But the reality is that the deficits have gotten larger. And as a result, in 08, 09, you needed really a proper hedge to the governments, not just the U.S., but Europe, Japan, debasing their bonds, really, right? Because they're issuing bonds at, you know, 0 or 1. And inflation is running at 2 to 3. So anyone investing in bonds is losing their purchasing power every single day. And that was the real thesis for behind gold, right? Just give me something that's going to protect me.
It sounds a lot like the setup of Bitcoin during COVID, where they had just printed a lot of money and people were looking for somewhere to hedge. And this was just happened to be the more accessible, more relatable asset, I guess, in this time period of time. And on that, I guess quickly, how does Bitcoin come into your radar? Because right now you have a big focus on crypto and Bitcoin. We're going to talk about your funds and your investment in Ledger and others. But when does Bitcoin come into your radar?
My gold business integrated with an exchange. It was a wallet. The first it was called BitReserve. BitReserve is now the Uphold wallet. GBI integrated with Uphold, the old Uphold, in 2013. And we became the first place that you could buy or sell gold to buy or sell Bitcoin or Ripple. So it came onto my radar around 2012, 2013. And, I was actually a bit active back then, trading a little bit. But I didn't really understand Bitcoin. That's the truth of it. Like I got that it was some sort of digital, you know, gold type thing. And I knew Barry Silbert from DCG pretty well. And Barry had sort of been a gold guy a little bit before Bitcoin. And it was hard to convince me, honestly. I kept trying to read the white paper and it didn't really make a lot of sense to me. Like it just, I couldn't understand it. So I tried over several years and, you know, I watched the markets go up and go down and go up and go down. And I think by 2018, we had that, you know, had that huge move into January of 18. And then we dropped 90% into Q4 18, Q1 19. And I just thought at that time, I've never given Bitcoin like the full analysis. We spent the first 20 minutes of today talking about how much analysis and work and process that we do and that I do. And I was a bit lazy with it because there were terms I didn't understand. Like, I didn't really know what an algorithm was. In a way, I knew what it was, but I didn't understand how one composes one. I wasn't a programmer. I didn't understand anything about cryptography. It's just very distant, you know, to understand something academic that I felt like you had to understand how Bitcoin worked, how the mechanism, the functioning, how the blockchains work, you know, how the miners work, how are they incentivized. It didn't make any sense to me. But then in, you know, Q1 19, I just said, okay, I'm going to lock myself up in my office in Greenwich in my house. And I spent essentially 6 months reading and listening to podcasts. And what was different at 19 versus 13 when I first got, you know, was aware of it, was that the literature explaining what Bitcoin was and the presence of Ethereum just made it easier for me. I mean, Safadie Amos' book came out. Jan Pritzker's book, Inventing Bitcoin, came out. That was a little later. But Antonopoulos' book was The Internet of Money, Volume 2. These were like pivotal books that I read. And then I started listening to people. And that's sort of when I, you know, Q1 19, Q2 19, started getting very involved. And then was trying to find a different way to get exposure aside from Bitcoin and ETH. How else can I get involved in the space? And at the time, the BlockFi, you know, they've gone under since, but I love the idea of borrow and lend, as you know, because we are an investor in Ledin. But I love the idea of borrow and lend, and this company, BlockFi, had come with a $50 million raise in the summer of 2019. And I tried to get into that personally and was unable to. And Andreessen led that round. It was just, and I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. There got to be a lot of companies that are more developed because I was more of a macro guy. I wanted an exposure to the overall space, but I wanted to have not so much risk in owning early stage venture companies. And I didn't want to compete with Andreessen and Polychain and, you know, Pantera. I didn't have that kind of tech background. So I, you know, I had my Bitcoin and ETH, and then I thought, all right, let's figure out how to get exposure to the equity of these larger companies. So I did. And we launched a fund in, it was December of 20. Well, we were going to launch March of 20. COVID hit. And then we were way late for like 6 months, ended up launching December 20, January of 21. With 10T, which of course is sort of my view about where the value of the ecosystem was going to go. And at the time, of course, I've said this many times, it was 300 billion. And I thought it could go from 300 billion to 10 trillion, which is a 30X. But I'm pretty sure that no one would believe me if I had said to them, oh yeah, I predicted a 30X return. So I put my view into the name of the fund. And that's where 10T came from. And that was the first three funds. And then we've changed the name now to One Roundtable Partners. And, you know, we, you know, have launched a fourth fund. And actually, we're going to have a fifth fund. It was, so the first three funds were growth, focused on growth equity. And there was lots of deals, as you know, in 21 and 22 to do, large deals. And we deployed $1.2 billion into 24 businesses, and I have board representation now on 12 of those. And The fourth fund ended up being a secondary specific fund, secondary and special situations. There weren't any growth deals to do in the past 18 months, 2 years. Originally, I thought we would do a growth fund, but there were no deals. So it's hard to tell investors, yeah, we have a pipeline of no deals, come invest with us. But there were massive discounts in the secondary market for companies we owned and for companies that we liked. And I mean 70, 80, 90% discounts. So we decided to pivot that fund into investing in secondaries. And we raised a nice little bit of money, not too big because it's very hard to deploy into the secondaries. They're smaller clips of stock, but we've been buying things at like 2 to 3 times revenue, which is preposterously low. I think that's probably changed now, but we allocated almost 60% of Fund 4 already over the last sort of 9 months into those kinds of deals. So those Fund 4 investors are going to be really happy.
You're describing what is a very textbook, you know, opportunistic investment to take advantage of a good time in the market in the middle of what was a break during the long-term trend, right? You saw a small detour, saw an opportunity to tack on a few more carts to the train, and then they went back on the tracks. And I think that's what every investor should strive for. My next question dovetails really nicely into this. You guys are very prolific investors. Most of your companies are in the larger growth stage, including LedIn. These companies, you know, for your investments and for the kind of plans that these companies have, public market liquidity and appetite just starts becoming quite relevant because I believe most of the companies in the portfolio, including LedIn, don't have a token. So they would most likely see a liquidity event through public markets or M&A. I think, and I've heard you, I saw you tweet about this. I believe that after the election, markets are at all-time highs, Bitcoin's at all-time highs. It seems like the IPO window could be opening again. Do you think we'll see more crypto-related IPOs in the next year?
Oh, yeah. I keep telling people, I said, look, I don't know anything with a 99% degree of certainty. Okay, I don't. But I know one thing with a 99% degree of certainty. And I've been saying this for the last 2 years, is that 5 years from now, Coinbase will not be the only large public crypto blockchain business in the world. Now, MicroStrategy, of course, has become large in the last few months. But the reality is that as a operating business, it's less of an operating business than a Bitcoin play than Coinbase. And so I suspect there are going to be 30, 40, 50, you know, companies in the next 5 years. The thirst is too great. There are a lot of institutional investors, a lot of traditional investors that can't own cryptocurrency. They can't own the Bitcoin ETF. They can't. And they're going to want to own businesses that are leveraged to growth in the space. And that was my original thought in 2019. That's my thought today. You've got the only avenue. You've got Bitcoin miners, which are really linked to Bitcoin, very volatile. But then you've got Coinbase, MicroStrategy, and Galaxy. Galaxy's a little smaller. But the valuations on some of the other big successful private companies is very low right now. And it's largely because in the last cycle, FTX really damaged the growth, traditional growth equity investors who came into the space. I mean, you know, people who invested in FTX, they got crushed. Also in the last cycle, many of the companies raised at preposterous valuations. And, you know, who knows whether they'll ever get back to those valuations. Companies, you know, at 80, 90 times revenue, thankfully we passed on almost all of those. We didn't really tend to invest more than 10 to 12 times revenue, which I thought was generous at the time. But guys like, you know, Thoma Bravo and Silver Lake and Tiger and Coatue and Temasek, there were many, many players, the Canadian pensions, they all came in and dipped their toe. And I think, you know, in some cases overpaid pretty dramatically. And the VCs didn't help. I mean, many VCs invested in OpenSea at a $13 billion valuation. you probably can buy that stock for under $1 billion today still. So there are many stocks, you know, copper, you know, even companies that we like, you know, like Firebox, and they raised at very high valuations. And so at the moment, the growth equity space is still empty. And I think we are really, I think we're the only growth equity fund in the world that's exclusively focused on crypto, Web3, blockchain, you know, digital assets, however you want to call it. But frankly, there have been no deals. But over the next 18 months, I think we're going to start seeing many more deals. The companies are more mature now than 3-4 years ago. We have companies, you know, that will make over $1 billion in revenue. You know, we have companies doing hundreds of millions in net profit. So, you know, in some cases, they need to clean their look up a little bit. They need to have maybe a more proper board structure. They may need to beef up certain committees, improve governance. And I think we're helping some of them with that. As I mentioned before, we have 12 board seats, actually also operating a business. One of our companies, we actually bought out of administration and are operating it. It's called Zenrock Labs. And it's, you know, we have a decentralized custody tech, MPC, a multi-party computation tech. And we're actually launching, I don't know what you'll think about this, but in about a month, we're going to be launching a decentralized yield-bearing wrapped Bitcoin. Not, I don't think, competitive with Ledin, because Ledin is centralized. And your clients, I think, are the entire traditional world. And I think our clients for ZenBTC are like super degen DeFi users, right? It's a different group. But, you know, that's been fascinating. A 1RT and 10T both have a stake in Zenrock Labs. And funnily enough, we actually are going to be having a token. The company's going to have a token launch in the next few weeks as well. So it's quite a departure in a way from Bitcoin only to Bitcoin and ETH to growth equity to secondary special sits, operating a business. And I think what we've become, you know, the team I've built, I mean, is the people we have never been better, level of professionalism much greater, certainly than what I had a few years ago. It's very tough to find quality people in the space. I hope that's going to start to change now. I don't know if you've had difficulty hiring, but it's very difficult, I found.
Well, you know, I'll speak to our experience working with the 10T team, and it's been spectacular. Like, you guys have been incredibly supportive. You've always been a huge partner to us. So I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm proud to be in the portfolio. I think it's a hell of a portfolio, and it's looking really good for the next few years.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, just since you're a gold expert. And
back to gold. All right.
Yeah, well, this will be Bitcoin and gold. So Trump just won the election. He's got plans for a strategic Bitcoin reserve. Currently, maybe. It's a plan. Currently, the United States holds $11 billion worth of gold approximately in its reserves from last I checked. And gold overnight, seemingly while we were sleeping, went from $11 trillion to now $17 trillion market. That's the total market cap of gold. So in relative terms, the U.S. has a very small percentage of the gold market cap in its reserves.
Yeah, but I don't think that gold reserve is marked to market.
You may be right. You're the expert here.
I think it's marked at $42.
Okay. So then that's significantly higher.
I think it is. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think, this big discussion about why that is and, you know, maybe they changed it, but I don't think so. I think it's held on the books at cost, I think. Or something like that. You know, gold was pegged for many years. It was at 24, then 35, and then the peg broke when Nixon took the dollar off. But I don't think they've revalued it. I may be wrong about that, but...
No, that's an interesting point, but I think the question is still valid in that The United States has, you know, 69,000 Bitcoin based on some reports on their reserves today. That's about $6.2 billion that they could just, you know, wave a magic wand and keep in the reserves rather than selling it. I guess the point that I want to ask you is Bitcoin today, even after the run-up, is a $1.75 trillion asset. Gold is a $17.5 trillion asset. It's one-tenth. If this reserve materializes, how big do you think Bitcoin can get in terms of market cap? And do you think that that will draw some investments from gold? Like, as in, do you think it would cannibalize gold?
I think it's seeing it a little bit, but I see it differently. I see gold as a good hedge for the fiat system. So if you're long stocks and bonds and you're afraid of general debasement, you know, and you don't have any crypto or Bitcoin, you're just a traditional guy, which is like 98% of the world, right? Or 95 or whatever number that it is. I think gold is a great hedge. Now, if you take all the assets that are denominated in dollars, so gold, dollar, NASDAQ, dollar, right? Bonds, dollar, or even in euro and yen. So you take all the world's assets that are priced in, are fiat, priced in a fiat world. So let's just say $700 to $800 trillion of assets, real estate, art, cars, you know, valuables, stocks, bonds, commodities, add all of the, all of that up. Okay. The fiat world, the entire fiat world will continue to depreciate against Bitcoin. Okay. And the entire digital asset world, because they're linked. So if you look at the last 10 years, just as an example, even the crappiest cryptocurrencies have outperformed, not all of them, okay, the top 50, let's just say, like Ripple, for instance. When I first bought Ripple in 2013, it was one-tenth of one penny. Ripple is at 70 cents today. Ripple, which people despise, okay, on Twitter and other places for whatever reasons, one-tenth of one penny 11 years ago. To 70 cents. So you can take any asset in the traditional world, and it has gotten annihilated against Ripple. It's gotten annihilated against ETH, against Solana, against Bitcoin. So my view is generally any substantial real asset in the digital asset world will maintain its purchasing power and outperform any asset in the old world. Okay. And this is why MicroStrategy right now is an example for a lot of people, because he's just sort of put it in the face of the old world and said, look, I'm an equity, but actually I'm just owning all this Bitcoin. And so they're starting to see how the Bitcoin has this appreciating function. It can appreciate at a pace that the fiat world cannot. Now, why is that? Because the fiat world is constantly increasing the supply of that fiat currency. Government spending in all the countries around the world de facto is an increase in the supply of total dollars, total euro, total yen, whatever it is. So you take something like Bitcoin, which has a finite supply. Ethereum, which everyone complains about, is pretty finite compared to a government, right? In some cases, people even think, given the ETH that gets burned, that it has negative supply. So I don't have anything anymore in the old world. I mean, I'm exclusively in the new world. And I mean, I still have gold, of course, but I think that there aren't many people yet who have that bigger view, this bigger macro view that I have, that everything in the fiat world. And so one last thing about this, there are people who have talked about the unsustainability of spending in the US and other places and have said, well, there'll be a debt jubilee. That was a term that Raoul Powell at Real Vision, you know, used to talk about. And that somehow there would be a forgiveness of the debt, that the debt would, we would have to default on the debt. And there was never going to be a default on any debt. And I kept saying, Raoul, stop saying that, because an actual default would be the end of humanity for a while, not forever, but for a little while. So there's never going to be a default. And what I said was, and I still believe this, is that if you think about that $800 trillion of assets, and you think about how much of those assets are fixed income bonds that are issued, it's a big portion. All of that debt is not going to default. It will simply be devalued against Bitcoin and the digital asset world. And so 10 years from now, we will wake up and all the boomers who own all the debt because they want their 4% coupon, their purchasing power is going to get completely annihilated versus the people who are holding assets in the digital world. And you can own any asset almost. You can own Bitcoin. You should. But I like having a portfolio. You own Bitcoin and Ethereum, maybe a little bit of Solana DAO. You have a little bit in a venture fund. And then you have a little bit in a growth fund as ours is. And, you know, we have a different risk reward profile. We're not trying to make 100x. You know, I'm not 30 years old and shooting for the moon. We'd be happy making a 5, you know, to 10x in our portfolio over a 10-year period, right? I have much more modest return expectations, you know, compared to the rest of the, you know, the crypto world. The crypto guys, you know, they're like, Dan, you know, that's a joke. You make a 5X, like, who cares, right? I made a 5X yesterday in my Dogecoin, right? And we don't do that. We don't invest in that stuff. But I understand, you know, why people do. And I think it's certainly the most vibrant investment area. There's nothing like this that I've ever seen. Like, nothing compares to it. Not even NASDAQ in 99. I mean, nothing. Like, the complexity and difficulty is multiples greater than anything I've ever experienced before. So, massive opportunity. And I think it's still early days. The ETF is giving people a little bit of a sense of things. But then I think eventually they'll come to realize this bigger thesis that we've talked about, you know, about the debasement of all the assets in the fiat world against the assets in the digital world. And I think your firm, Ledin, is a fantastic spot. I feel like you are a bridge from the traditional world to the new world. And people who all of a sudden they buy Bitcoin and it was 100 grand and now it's 9 million and they don't want to sell any. So basically they need to borrow against Bitcoin. It's the most normal thing. No one who has a significant amount of Bitcoin wants to sell it. So where do you go? You go to Ledin and you can borrow against your Bitcoin and then you can move out of your grandmother's basement. You know, buy that apartment that you wanted to buy. You know, you got to live, right? You have to live a little bit, but you don't want to sell your Bitcoin. So I think the Ledin business, and you guys did an incredible job surviving 3AC and BlockFi and Celsius. And now I don't see why you can't become the biggest lender in the world. That's kind of what I'm expecting from you and Adam. And I don't know why your company can't be worth billions of dollars. So why? Because I think you have a monopoly really right now, not a monopoly, but you don't have that many competitors yet. And, you know, so I'm very excited about that, you know, that prospect.
As are we, and we're very lucky and feel fortunate to have a partner like you. That's obviously you're so thoughtful in every step you take. So it's huge. It's a huge asset for us to be able to work with people like you to basically take over this opportunity. Because I agree with you. We have a clean shot at one of the biggest opportunities, the biggest one I've seen in my life. So
you could be surprised at how much wealth you end up creating. So, but I would, now is the time to focus. This is our, you know, 18 hours a day now. You know, the last 18 months has been kind of slow a little bit back and forth, even with ETF and Larry Fink. You know, it wasn't until, and this is the same thing that happened, by the way, at the last high in 2020 in November, December, the market had been rallying a lot, but not until Bitcoin broke 20,000, which was the 17 peak, did, and then we went straight to 60,000, right? But not until we broke 20 did people get all excited again. So we just broke the all-time high, which was around 70, right? 65, 70, a week or two ago. And let me just say one thing. This administration, there is nothing that is more bullish from a political standpoint that has ever happened to Bitcoin and crypto. The U.S. government, the leading government in the world, with the largest economy and the wealthiest population, has taken on crypto on their platform. We have a vice president and a president who have digital wallets, who own cryptocurrency. They have NFTs. Elon Musk is, you know, not just Dogecoin specialist, but, you know, the greatest entrepreneur of my generation. You know, we have the richest man in the world who is now the head of an agency, I guess, that's going to clean up the excess spending with Vivek. I mean, things are so extremely positive. I'm nervous. Like, I just hope they don't try to go after Trump again. Some crazy tries to attack him. You know, he's, you know, what he is doing is, I think, akin to, this is a real structural upward revolution. I've been waiting, and many people like me, capitalists, market people, I've been waiting essentially my whole life for this. We had a taste of business running things with Reagan. But the reality is we have not had a real business person, a real markets person ever. The first Trump administration, I think there were a lot of growing pains. And he's the only president ever that could tell you where the S&P 500 closed that day. And I just think he, lots of problems and distractions, and people were attacking him. He has a mandate now. They won the Senate, the House, the entire popular vote. And you can feel it on Twitter and on other places that the philosophy behind this group of people is ascendant. And it's definitely a revocation of the woke culture. And I think that was infecting a lot of things. I don't want to really go there because I tend to, at least publicly, I want to focus on business and markets and the economy and fiscal spending. These are the kinds of things, you know, that I actually have expertise on. Everyone's allowed to have their own political views. You know, I'm not really interested in those political views, but I think we have to sit back and understand this is more than just a powerful upward chip. I mean, we haven't experienced anything like this before from a macroeconomic perspective, not just, hey, it's good for crypto. I mean, the president has said many times he's firing Gary Gensler, who is the head of the SEC, because he wants someone there who is going to be more entrepreneurial, open-minded, and de facto open to cryptocurrency and the companies like the ones that we own that are innovating. And the worst thing that happened in the last, you know, 5 years, even beyond, is that, you know, innovators were being pushed outside of America, right? And I think with Ledin as an example, you guys, it's even worse for you. You know, being in Canada was a disaster, and thank goodness you moved out. But, you know, maybe now, of course, after new leadership comes in, you know, a big chunk of your business used to be in the U.S. And maybe that's really going to come back now. And so, right? I mean, Canada, who knows? Like, I think you stay away from Canada. That guy there, I don't really know that he knows what he's doing. And I'm talking about the president or premier.
Yeah, Trudeau. Yeah.
I mean, he's destroyed that economy. Maybe that changes. Maybe you know, they see what the U.S. is doing, and we start sucking in all the talent from Canada. You know, a lot of smart people, a lot of capable people there. But if you have a hostile environment, it's just like, why do you want to live with that, right? And so the positive shock that we're having now in the U.S., I mean, I don't see why the stock market here won't double, you know, in the next sort of 5 years. And Bitcoin in 2019, my target was always 300, 350,000. My target, my first stopping point was 10 trillion. That's for the value of the whole ecosystem. So that's Bitcoin, ETH, all the cryptocurrencies and all the equity, which is now at around 3.5 trillion. So we're still 7 trillion away from my initial target, but I think that 10T is going to be too low. Like, that's an outdated thing. You know, I walk around with 10T, you know, that's going to be outdated. So I just, it's hard to adjust to moments very quickly. Like, this happened and it feels like everything changed overnight, right? It's, what is that quote? That's, I forgot that quote. There are decades where...
Yeah, there's decades where nothing happens and there's weeks where decades happen or something along the lines of that.
Something like that. So I think that's what's happening. I couldn't be more pleased about our focus. I think, yes, all of the IPO and M&A and everything is going to open up over the next 18 months. I'm not saying there won't be fits and starts, but, you know, you yourself experienced being in Canada, just how difficult the environment was, roadblocks at every turn, right? Now we have the wealthiest man in the world, the most successful entrepreneur of our generation involved in the governance of the wealthiest and largest country in the world. I mean, what else can I say? I mean, I think we got to end this podcast on that. I mean, I can't say anything more. And it's massively bullish for cryptocurrency, just to have the shackles removed a little bit, to have people who really understand the value of building these businesses in the U.S. again. I mean, look, it's a global industry. It's a global business. 75% of all the trading volume is still done outside of the U.S. That's fine. I mean, it's a global business. But the U.S. was at risk in the last 2 or 3 years of really falling behind, like in a real way. If we had another 4 years of hostility, I think we would really be in a bad position 4 years from now. And now there's hope. It's morning in America again. And it's morning in America for crypto. And I think also DeFi crypto US, which, you know, the whole DeFi world shut down. That's a whole other separate point. But
I think this is a great place to leave it at. And we can, I would love to have you back in a few months to revisit how we're tracking. But this has been phenomenal, Dan. I thank you very much for your time.
I hope that within a few months, you are too busy to do a podcast in the middle of the day with me. That's my hope, and I would maybe bet on that.
I'm with you there. I'm with you there, and I make a big effort to get these episodes out because the feedback we get from our clients is that they love hearing from us and hearing from people like you on where our views in the markets are. It helps them connect with the brains behind Ledin and the mission behind Ledin. So for me, it's like whenever I stop making these, I start getting inbounds from people saying, "Where are they? What happened?" And so I have to keep a cadence.
That just means you're gonna have to just work longer days. That's all.
Hell yes.
All right. Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. This was fun.
What a privilege it is to be able to discuss macroeconomics with one of the world's best macro investors and to have him in our corner here at Ledin. One of the things I've really enjoyed throughout building Ledin has been getting to know and work with people that I admire. I've learned a lot from our team members, investors, and our partners over the last 6 years. It's hard not to come off that conversation feeling optimistic about the future of Bitcoin and digital assets. Successful investors know how to identify shifts in markets and how to position their investments to ride growth waves and build wealth. And Dan's story is a perfect example of making thoughtful, long-term investments with high conviction. And he's been rewarded pretty handsomely. I hope that this conversation resonated with you as it did with me, and I'd love to hear your feedback. Happy Bitcoin all-time highs, everybody, and we'll be back soon with another great guest. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.